Howdy. Ninth generation Texan, distinguished alumnus at Texas A&M University, outstanding alumnus of the Mays College of Business, I'm honored to introduce to you my dear friend and our Congressman Bill Flores. I've known Bill for over 43 years, beginning in 1972 as members of the Centennial Class of 1976 at Texas A&M. We were in the Corps of Cadets together, and until now, Gina and Bill have been lifelong friends. I had the pleasure of introducing Bill, and we'll see after this if it's going to continue. I had the pleasure of introducing Bill in 2010 during one of his original campaign events. At that time, I told the audience that Bill would be effective and he would work hard as our congressman. In just 5 years, he was appointed to serve on the powerful House Energy and Commerce Committee, the oldest committee in Congress. He was elected by his fellow congressmen to serve as the chair of the Republican Study Committee. He's authored legislation intended to, among other things, protect our veterans and hold the VA more accountable, limit the growth of government, make it more accountable. When he comes home, he holds town hall meetings through all of the communities with his constituents. And if his schedule permits, he attends every function that he's invited to as a congressman. Now, as I introduced him to you 5 years later, I can tell you that I was right about him. No one in Congress works harder, smarter, or more effectively than Bill Flores. Most important to me, though, is not how hard he works, but that he possesses the essential qualification for public service. He puts service to us and to our country above his self-interest. He prays daily, seeking God's will in his service. His integrity is unquestioned. I'm proud to call him my friend, but I feel very lucky that I can call him my congressman. Please help me welcome Congressman Bill Flores.
Well, howdy. I guess after this, Chuck and I are going to be friends. Teddy, can I maintain you as a friend? So. It's great to be here, great to be back in Brazos County and the Brazos Valley. It's great to call this place home. My wife, Gina, and I are just thrilled to be here today. I want to start out by apologizing because I know that about 200 of you bought tickets for this same event when I was supposed to speak, and you had to watch a video of me, and I don't videotape very well. Anyway, what happened is we had a little government shutdown that sort of messed up all the congressional schedules, and I apologize for that. I didn't play a big part in it, but I do apologize for it. But anyway, we finally got back, some 2 years later, we finally get back on the schedule. That gives you kind of a feel for the for a congressional schedule. Royce, I'm going to take a little bit of liberty today and invite you back up here to the stage with me, if you don't mind. A few of you know that a few weeks ago, Royce was recognized during a special tribute to Royce Hickman by the Brazos Valley Museum of Natural History. And some of you may or may not realize that I went to the floor of the House of Representatives and did a special tribute to Royce Hickman about that same time. And I'd like to read that because it's part of this nation's congressional record. It says, "Mr. Speaker, I rise today to honor Royce Hickman, an outstanding individual who has been serving as the president and CEO of the Bryan College Station Chamber of Commerce since 1998. Royce has held a number of high-profile positions throughout his business career. He is a past member of the Executive Committee of the Texas Association of Business. In addition, he served on the Board of Directors as chairman of the Texas Chamber of Commerce Executives just recently. Royce was presented with the 2014 Distinguished Service Award by the Texas Chamber of Commerce Executives. He was awarded this recognition for his leadership as chairman of the state organization. During his time as chairman, he led the organization toward its current thriving position. Royce is a past chairman of the Texas A&M Association of Former Students, a past president of the Friends of the Sterling C. Evans Library, and in 2007 was presented with the International Excellence Award in the community by Texas A&M University. He currently serves on the George Bush School of Government and Public Services Development Council, the Texas A&M Career Center Advisory Council, and the Bush School Public Service Organization Advisory Board. He also serves on the March of Dimes Board and on several committees of his church. Royce is a great asset to the Brazos Valley. His service to our community has helped it grow and prosper, He has shown tremendous dedication and willingness to go above and beyond the call of duty. Most importantly, he has been a committed husband to his wife, Mary, and a nurturing leader for his children and grandchildren. Today, we are thrilled to recognize and honor Royce Hickman's devotion, dedication, and loyalty to our nation, our state, our community, and his family. Mr. Speaker, before I close, I ask everyone to continue to pray for our country and for our military men and women that protect it. God bless the United States of America, and is signed by Bill Flores. I meet with a lot of chambers, and this chamber is well led not only by its volunteer leadership on its board and by those that are by its membership, but it's well led by those that are paid in paid positions. And the culture and the leadership is set by Royce Hickman at the top. I have a few other introductions I'd like to make. First of all, I want to start with the introduction of two special women, young women from Stratford, Texas. So, Marka Ewers, would you stand up? Marka, where are you? Okay, over here. Marka is class of 2006, and she was actually, I don't know when she did it. She must have been 18 when she did it. She was the mayor of Stratford for a while, grew up in the same little town that Gina and I grew up in, and followed in my grandfather's footsteps as the mayor of that thriving metropolis of 1,700 people. And Marka's back in town anyway. I want to take some liberty and introduce her. The next special woman from Stratford, Texas, is my wife of 37 years, Gina. Gina, would you stand up? So she doesn't like it when I do this to her. But it takes a lot to be a congressional spouse, and I hope. Just keep her in your prayers, too. She's a special lady. I have some staff introductions to make. You've already met Jeff Morehouse, our chief of staff. James Edge, everybody knows. James, stand up. Stay standing if you would. James takes care of he's our regional director for the southern part of the district. He's worked in the Bryan office. Jana Hickson is regional director for the northern part of the district. Just joined the Flores team, works in our Waco office. Just stole her from Baylor University. They're all mad at me now about that. And Miranda Henderson works in the Bryan office, is a caseworker and a grants coordinator. Let's see who else. Is Jessica McKinney here today? Jessica McKinney is a field rep for the Waco office, and we've got we should have Andre Castro here as well. Takes care of communications for me. I thank all of them for what they do. They make my job a lot easier. Thank you. I want to thank Chuck and Teddy for sponsoring today's event. They are dear, dear friends, at least until now, and at least Teddy is. Anyway, they are dear friends, and it's really neat for me to have them sponsor a luncheon where I get to be the speaker. As many of you know, we're in the middle of what's called the August recess. I always call it an August work period for Congress, and the nation is safer when Congress is out of town. But we're busy. Yeah, I know. Applause. We are actually very busy right now. We're halfway through our town hall series, and during our summer town hall series, we do the smaller communities so that they don't feel left out. And so we've done Grosbeck and Cameron. We're going to wrap up with Buffalo and Franklin tomorrow. We've had three Chamber of Commerce meetings. We've had two ag breakfasts, and we've had numerous other meetings with our constituents. And what they tell me is pretty fascinating, and we're going to start to find out what you think on a few things. I have three poll questions to ask you. The first one is, do you think America's on the right track or wrong track? So those of you who think it's on the right track, please hold your hands up. Those of you who think it's on the wrong track, hold your hands up. Okay. You reflect what the Americans feel today, intense frustration with the direction of the country. About 75% of the country thinks that we're on the wrong track. Now, there are a bunch of reasons for that, and I'm going to try to drill in and get you to tell me what you think the most important reason is, and that is, what's the most important issue facing America today? So again, the question is, what's the most important issue facing America today? I'm going to ask you to vote on this. I'm going to run through the list of seven items. Actually, I'm going to I'll shorten it to six items, and ask you to vote on one of them. I'll run through it twice, and then on the third time we'll vote. Jobs and economy, federal spending and deficits, border security and immigration, presidential overreach, defense, national security, foreign policy, or climate change. Okay, I'm going to run through those again. No all of the above. There's no all of the above. So, and you only get to vote once. So jobs and economy, federal spending and deficits, border security and immigration, presidential overreach, defense, national security, foreign policy, and climate change. Vote one time, please. Jobs and economy. Okay, a few of you. Okay. Federal spending and deficits. Okay, a bunch of you. Border security and immigration. A couple of you. Okay. Presidential overreach. Okay. Defense and national security. Okay. And climate change. Okay. So I think the winners in this one, not the winners, I mean, I hate to say it, it's not the winners, the biggest losers, if you will, were federal spending and deficits and defense and national security. You pretty well reflect what every town hall meeting has told me since this time last year. Fiscal matters are number one, and shortly behind that are defense and national security. Now, so talking about national security for a minute, there are sort of three big threats out there, and I want you to tell me what you think the biggest threat is in your mind. So there are three of them. I'm going to give you a choice. Again, vote one time. Iran, China, or the Islamic State. I've been to the Middle East now five times in the last 4 years, and I've watched as these one of the threats has developed in particular, or two of the threats. And so I'd like you to vote. So those of you that think Iran is the biggest threat, please raise your hands. Okay, China. Okay, and then the Islamic State. Okay. Now, you reflect the feelings of what I'm seeing pretty much throughout the district. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about what's going on in Washington, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what's coming up when we go back into session a week from yesterday on September the 8th, and then if we have some time, we'll open it to Q&A, and I'll try to be brief in my remarks. As Chuck said, I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee. It's a committee that I'm ideally suited to be on, and I'm not trying to tout myself, but if you look at the jurisdiction of that committee, it's very broad. It's the oldest committee in Congress. It has jurisdiction over everything from telecommunications to pharmaceuticals to health care to environmental policy to energy to consumer safety. You name it, this committee has some oversight over it. It is a very active committee. Earlier this year, we passed something out of committee unanimously on a bipartisan basis called 21st Century Cures. It deals with the way we fund the National Institutes of Health in order to try to come up with world-class research to go after the diseases that are hurting our American families and are costing our families and costing the taxpayers. And so the 21st Century Cures Act, it's actually an idea that grew out of the Republican Study Committee that I'm honored to chair today. And so I just want to let you know there are positive things coming out of Congress. You don't see it very often, but there are. Coming up on the radar screen, we're working on something called Architecture of Abundance. It has to deal with putting together a 21st century energy strategy for this country. And I'm pleased to say that a lot of it's modeled on something that Bobby Jindal and I wrote last year called Organizing for Abundance. They even stole part of the name of our document. And it talks about how to build a true all-the-above energy solution so that we can have a robust economy moving forward. We've also got to deal with some issues that have been raised that have come up from the FCC, something called net neutrality. We also have a niche project we're working on today. I'm working on with Joe Barton, who's our congressional neighbor to the northeast of here, one of the five Aggies in Congress. Joe and I are trying to lift the ban on the export of oil from this country. We're now the number one oil producer in the world, number one natural gas producer. It makes no sense why we can't have a free and fair and open market for everything. I mean, we'd expect to be able to do that with Chevys. Why can't we do it with oil? So that's something we're working on. In terms of the Republican Study Committee, those of you that don't know anything about that, it's something that was set up in the early 70s to try to provide a conservative influence on the direction of the House of Representatives. There are 170 members of it. It's the largest caucus in Congress today. I am the third Texan that's been honored to chair this committee. The first was Sam Johnson, who was a Vietnam POW, a true American hero. The next is a native of Bryan College Station, Jeb Henserling, and I am the third. We have sort of three agendas. I'll hit those pretty quickly. The first one is I call getting things done, getting positive things done. There are five things under that. I sound like a Baptist preacher here for a minute. But there are five things that are part of getting things done. One is to grow the American economy instead of Washington bureaucracy. The second one is to fix the fiscal nightmare in Washington. The third one is to restore our national strength and our national defense. The fourth is to protect American values of life and family. And the fifth is to restrict the federal government to its constitutionally limited role. Now, those are the aspirational goals of the Republican Study Committee. What I have noticed in my 4.5 years in Congress is the next item, the kicked cans, are the ones that disrupt that aspirational agenda. And I am committed to try to avoid letting those kicked cans cause problems. Now, what are the kicked cans? Things like transportation bills, debt ceilings, the inability to pass a normal appropriations bill to fund a part of the government. Those are the types of things that have become issues in the past. Those of you in the healthcare community keep hearing about the doc fix. Well, we fixed it. And so forever. And we saved $2.5 trillion over most of your kids' lifetimes by doing that. And so those are the types of things, that the kick cans. And what I'm trying to do with this huge group of folks in the House is put conservative fingerprints on these things before they ever get to the floor so we can avoid the food fight that typically happens in Congress. For instance, if the debt ceiling comes up, I hate debt ceiling votes, but I'm not a big fan of shutting governments down either, particularly the world's largest government. And so why not put things on that make it more palatable? Things like approving the Keystone Pipeline or lifting the oil export ban or whatever. You know, you can come up with a whole bunch of ideas, or fiscal reforms or dealing with entitlements that are bankrupt. So our goal is to try to do things to exert a positive conservative influence on that debt ceiling vote when it comes up so that it's not an issue, so we don't take our eyes off the aspirational goal. The third major agenda item that we have is, I call it bureaucratic behavioral modification. And we started out really strong. There's two ways to do things in Congress. One is through the authorizing process. One of us comes up with a great idea. We propose a piece of legislation, goes to the committee, it passes the House, passes the Senate, goes to the President signs it or vetoes it. That is not working. It hasn't worked now very well for the last 4.5 years because we have divided government. We got some people in the House feel one way about things. We got some people in the Senate feel a different way about things. We got a president that feels differently than what the House feels. And so because of that, you can't agree on what needs to be done in the authorizing front. Now, the second way to get things done in Congress is through appropriations. So that when you're getting ready to fund a section of government, you can say, okay, this agency can no longer do these bad things that you've been doing. We're removing the funding for that. And we, through the Republican Study Committee, we had put 200-plus policy writers on appropriations bills to clean up bureaucratic behaviors so that they stay within their constitutional and statutory boxes that Congress designed for them early on. We were doing really well. We had 6 of 12 appropriations bills passed in the House. We were doing the 7th, but then a couple of things happened. One is the first appropriations bill in the Senate got blocked from being considered, and that was the defense appropriations. It's always been a bipartisan appropriations bill. It got blocked, and then the Charleston shootings happened, and then the other party in the House started adding Confederate flag amendments to the appropriations bills in the House. So the process broke down. What does that mean? That means we're going to have a continuing resolution, an omnibus appropriations bill to fund the government starting October the 1st. That'll be one of the things we have to deal with. So we'll still continue this third agenda item of trying to use policy writers through appropriations, use the appropriations process to change behavior, to keep the APA from saying that the water that falls on your field outside of town is subject to their jurisdiction. Those are the types of things, the behaviors that we're trying to change. Now, I want to talk, a lot of people are, if I were to ask you a question, how many of you are frustrated? I'm not going to ask you because I know. Most of you would hold your hand up, frustrated with Washington. I do want to say there have been some good things that have happened that I don't think Congress gets credit for, and particularly the House, because most of this is coming out of the House today. As I said, we did have a good effort at passing 6 of 12 appropriations bills. That hadn't happened in a long time. We were really on track to go through what the transparent process of funding government that you want instead of using continuing resolutions. We did pass the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act that was signed into law. That act is going to be what we use to vote up or down on the Iranian deal that the president made with the Iran folks sometime this month. We passed Trade Promotion Authority. It's been signed into law. Unfortunately, there's a lot of rhetoric, confusing rhetoric about that act. But if you believe that free and fair trade is good for the economy and good for the paychecks of hardworking Americans, then you believe in free trade, and you believe in having fast-track agreements that allow presidents to negotiate those. And if you want to have a deal that has a high likelihood of success, of congressional approval, then you put into the fast-track agreement what you want the president to do when he or she negotiates that agreement. And we've done that. And so now the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be the first thing on the floor of the Congress in the next few months. And if the president checks all the boxes that we've required him to check, 150-plus boxes, then that'll pass and that'll be good for this country. It'll be good for our farmers and our large and small businesses. We also, for those of you in the healthcare profession or those of you on Medicare, we repealed the sustainable growth rate or the doc fix, as I said earlier. That is signed into law. That was bipartisan. It took a lot of effort. It's the first entitlement reform in over 20 years. And it's just the first step we need in terms of going after the entitlement challenges that we have in this country. The House, those are all law now. Now, the things that we need to do that we passed that we still need to work through the Senate and through the President on, through the White House, are the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. Basically says if an unborn child is capable of feeling pain, that's typically around 20 weeks or 5 months, that you cannot abort that child. The repeal of the death tax, which was an initiative that came out of the Republican Study Committee that helps our small businesses and our farmers. The RAINS Act, which totally changes the regulatory process in Washington. The Wall Street Journal says it'd be the single biggest regulatory reform done in decades in this country, and it would be good for the country. 21st Century Cures, I've already talked about. The VA Accountability Act, the Student Success Act. You don't hear a lot about this. But everybody knows about No Child Left Behind, right? How many of you do not like No Child Left Behind? How many of it hurts you, your schools? Now, virtually every administrator, every teacher, every parent, every school board member will tell you that No Child Left Behind has been a... Thank you, sweetie. By the way, I'm sorry about the way I sound. I've got a cold, and so I'm just lucky I can talk at all after this week. What the Student Success Act does is it reauthorizes No Child Left Behind, but it totally changes it. It basically says, let's reduce the federal footprint in K-12 education, and let's give more of that authority back to state and local school districts, back to families, to parents. And it also says, and it changes the funding model so that the money still flows, but with a lot fewer federal requirements on it than what you have today. So, now, a lot of people said, why don't you just totally get the federal government out of education? They'd call that a touchdown. Well, this gets about 30 yards down the road toward improving K-12, the relationship of the federal government with respect to K-12 education. And when I pull my voting card out and vote, I've got a yes option and I've got a no option. I don't have a no but let and wait for perfect option. I don't have a perfect button on that machine. And so... if I vote no on something like Student Success Act, that means I'm basically voting for status quo, which is to keep No Child Left Behind in place. And I'll take 30 yards of progress toward perfect any day of the week because perfect is not available when you have a Washington that's set up the way it is today. So Student Success Act, if we can get it through the Senate, they've already done their education bill. We can marry those up. I think you're going to see our local school boards and teachers and administrators and families a lot happier. We also have repealed the IPAB, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, which helps seniors with Medicare. I'm hopeful the Senate will take it out. We repealed the medical device tax. We have the first budget agreement between the House and Senate since 2001 that balances in less than 10 years. We also had an early vote on repeal of the Affordable Care Act. That was another initiative out of the Republican Study Committee. We felt like we owed our freshman members that just got elected last November a chance to vote on that because many of them voted on it. Ratepayer Protection Act deals with the EPA's influence on some of our generating facilities. It's a big influence for Texas. We reauthorized intelligence agencies with some modifications, no more bulk collection of data by the NSA. America Competes Reauthorization Act, which deals with intellectual property and patent law. We approved the Keystone Pipeline. That was also passed by the Senate. It was vetoed by the President, and a variety of other things. And another thing you don't realize is, going back and if you look at the debt ceiling votes that we've had over the last 4 years, in one of those, we were able to come up with a budget agreement that actually cut spending in the federal government by $2.1 trillion over 10 years. That is the first major reduction in spending in the federal government in decades. And as you see, what you've seen is the price of government has been less over each of the last 4 years than it was on the day you elected me to serve as your representative. So those are some of the things we've done. Now, what's coming up? What are the things that could be of impact to Bryan College Station? The first one is the Iran deal. I've published op-eds in all the major newspapers in this district, so you know where I stand on that. During our Q&A, if you'd like to bring it up, we can. We're going to vote to lift the crude oil export ban. Hopefully that's going to happen in September, October. Highway reauthorization, we're operating under a temporary extension through October the 29th. We've got to come up with hopefully a 5 or 6 year extension so that our states can deal with the transportation issues they have, and we're trying to come up with a funding model to deal with that as well. I've been working with Paul Ryan, the chairman of the Ways and Means, and I think I wasn't really enthralled with the plan that he came up to do the funding part of it, but the more I've talked to him, the more I think that he's on the right track. We're going to get an international tax reform to use as the funding component for it. That's something that our businesses need, and I'm hopeful that this will pass. Many of you have seen what Planned Parenthood has done, so that investigation, those hearings are going to be going on. Those are going to happen in the Energy and Commerce Committee as well as two other committees. And then the First Amendment Defense Act is something that needs to be considered in light of the Supreme Court's ruling on marriage. Now, there could be situations where certain people's religious liberties are infringed upon by the federal government. We're still trying to make sure those are protected in light of the Supreme Court ruling. So, got a busy agenda. And with that, I'd like to open the floor to questions. Royce, how long do I have? About
at least 10 minutes.
Okay, so about 10 minutes worth of questions, and I'll try to keep my answers short so we can get as many of them in as we can. So don't be bashful. Golly, this is easy. There we go, back in the back. Yes, sir. Now, I can't hear out of this ear because it's still at 30,000 feet, so speak up. Well, I was, the question was, what's the most likely outcome of the Iranian vote? Did I characterize your question correctly? In the House, we will vote to disprove it. In the Senate, they will vote to disprove it. In all likelihood, Harry Reid, the minority leader, said they're going to try to filibuster it. The president has already said he's going to veto the disapproval. And so the House would likely override the disapproval. I think we can get 290 votes to override the veto. But as of a few minutes ago, the President and Harry Reid have said they've got 34 votes in the Senate, which would allow them to not be able to override the veto. So it looks like it's going to go into effect. I'm not giving up yet. I think that if any of you have looked at history and looked at the deal that Neville Chamberlain made with Adolf Hitler back in 1938, he made a really bad decision. This one is much, much worse. Now, some of you may disagree with me, but I can tell you after being in the Middle East 5 times and talking to people that are directly affected by this, not only of their leaders of the Gulf states, the Omans, the UAEs, the Qatars, those countries. But you talk to the leaders of Iraq, you talk to the leaders of Afghanistan, you talk to the leader of Israel. Gina and I were just in Israel 3 weeks ago, and I sat right in front of the Prime Minister of Israel, and he walked through the dangers of this deal. This is a world-class moment. In 13 years, the breakout period for Iran to have a nuclear weapon will be like that. Now, what does 13 years mean? Well, let's put that in perspective. It's been, 14 since we had 9/11. That means our two granddaughters are going to be teenagers when there's a threat of an Iranian nuclear weapon plus the ability to deliver it to the United States or Israel or Europe or anywhere in the world. That is not something that I think is a positive move. There were five tests that the president and the State Department had when they went into those negotiations that they swore to us would be part of a final agreement, and they did not achieve one of those five standards for an acceptable agreement. So I consider it to be gravely important, and I will continue to do all I can to fight it. So I know we may have disagreement in here, but General Ramirez is shaking his head with me, and that reminds me that three-quarters of the people that are experts in national defense in this country say that this deal is a wrong deal. And they're far more expert in this than I am. So I believe them. Next question. Sorry to end on that, sir. Yes, sir. Oh, crud. Next question. No. I try not to shirk from questions, but let me answer it sort of this way. This is my politician hat coming out on. So I'd rather have our let me rephrase that. I haven't said the word Republican or Democrat in here in this thing yet, except for Republican Study Committee, but that's that's a proper name for our group. I'd rather have the Republican bench of candidates to look at than the other side's candidates to look at. So let's say that. There are some people among the 17 or so, I don't know how many it is anymore, the 17 or so people that are running on my side of the aisle that carry the Republican banner, that I'm pretty excited about. I think they'd make great leaders. And here's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the next sort of a Reagan. That's what I'd like to see. Somebody that builds this country up and talks about the inherent goodness of the people of this country and their families and turn our communities loose to do what they do best. I'm hoping that we'll have a Reagan emerge from this scrum that's running around out there. My hope is also that some of them will act like statesmen and quit throwing bombs at each other. So I don't know if you remember my race, but I always tried to run against my other party opponent, even all through the primary and the runoff. One time I said something about my runoff opponent, and I wish I hadn't done that because my goal was to run against who I consider to be the person I wanted to challenge for this. And I wish that the 17 people would do that and talk about what they want for this country, what makes this country great, how they can make it great again. And I'm not coining Trump's phrase there. But that's what I'd like to see. But I am excited about the bench. There are some of them that I'm really thrilled about. Yes, sir.
What joy did you get out of being Congress?
I don't get speeding tickets anymore. No. Scott DeLucia knows that firsthand. So Scott and I were on the radio doing our Wednesday show one day. I'm going to answer your question. Anyway, I was going too fast through Hearn, heading over to Austin, and I got pulled over, and the policeman, and so I announced to Scott, I got to jump off, I'm getting pulled over. So he laughs, and I hang up, and the policeman comes up, and I hand him my stuff. He says, "Are you Mr. Flores?" I said, "Yes." He says, "Oh, shoot, I was afraid that was you," because he was listening to WTAW. And so he said, "Go on down the road, but slow down." And I said, "Yes, sir." And so I was on my way, and I called Scott back a few minutes ago and explained what happened. I mean, not a few minutes ago, but a few minutes later, and we continued the show. So anyway, the show's got to go on, right, Scott? Anyway, the greatest joy I get, seriously speaking, is we'll have, we've got, Miranda Henderson is in the audience here. And we've got four caseworkers on our staff. And we'll have a veteran come in, and they're having problems with the VA, or we'll have somebody that's having trouble with the IRS, or we'll have somebody that's, waited weeks to get a passport because they want to go see their dying mother in Germany or something like that. And the bureaucracy has failed them. And we are able to step into the breach and get them what they need. And so I have to say that the work of my team brings joy to my heart. Also, the look on people's faces when you're able to get legislation done that to recognize somebody that needs to be recognized. One I can think of is an African-American gentleman named Dory Miller. He was a hero during World War II at Pearl Harbor. And he had never really been properly recognized for his heroism that day. He was a cook, and he actually shot down enemy aircraft. He wasn't trained to do that, but he rescued his dying captain from the bridge of the ship and got him safety. And he ultimately died. But then he grabbed an anti-aircraft gun and started shooting people down. Well, we named the VA hospital in Waco after him. So those are the types of things that bring joy to my heart. I'd like to say it's because I single-handedly balanced the budget and reset the course of the country, but until I get a better Senate, that's going to be a little tougher to do. So, but I hope that makes sense. John. Let me paraphrase the question if I can. Congress has not been very effective in stopping the EPA. I guess that's what I'd say. And I have to concur with you. And I go back to the sort of the introductory part of our conversation today. There's two ways for Congress to do things. One is through the authorizing process, and I can introduce a bill and says, okay, EPA, you cannot redefine the statutory definition of the waters of the U.S. of navigable waters under the Clean Water Act. But the problem is that our friends in the Senate on the other side of the aisle say, no, we want the EPA to do that. And so you grind down to a stop. And even if, for some reason, something like that passed the Senate, the president's going to veto it, and we don't have enough votes to override. So you're back to status quo. You've got an EPA that's way outside the statutory limitations that Congress set for them decades ago. The other way is to use the appropriations process, and that's to basically say, okay, EPA, you can't use any money to try to implement this ill-conceived rule. And again, you have the same issue. Unless you can get something like that on a must-pass piece of legislation, you can't use the appropriations process. I thought we had a pretty good chance earlier this year when I was using my bureaucratic behavioral modification project, but when the appropriations process broke down, we lost our ability to do that. Now, to try to go to the sort of the other part of your question, so what happens is we have status quo, and so that's where you have to rely on the courts to intervene under the Constitution and stop some of this. And so we had, you look at the president's action on expanding DACA. He got a South Texas judge to stop that. On the EPA's WOTUS rule, you've got a judge in North Dakota to stop that for 13 states. There will undoubtedly be other judges to stop it for Texas and the other 37 states. To answer the next part of your question related to the bill I was talking about coming out of EUC, Architecture of Abundance, that will be an aspirational vision of what a 21st century energy strategy looks like for the country. We will get that bill written. We'll roll it out. It'll pass the House, probably pass the Senate. I don't think the president will sign it, so it won't go anywhere. But what it will be is something that the presidential candidates can talk about in terms of what their vision is if they can get elected and work with Congress to get positive things done for the American people. I'll give you another example. Scott Walker called me three Saturdays ago and said, hey, the Republican Study Committee has introduced a bill with more co-sponsors than any other health care reform bill ever called the American Health Care Reform Act. And again, this is the group that I chair. And it's a 21st century vision for reforming health care, getting out of the Affordable Care Act and moving to a patient-centered, private market-based solution. He said, can I use that in my campaign? I said, certainly, you can. Because I know it's not going to become law, but at least we're putting forth what our aspirations are for the real-world way to deal with health care. So that's what we're trying to do. Next question. Yes, sir, Steve. The question was, short of a crisis, what will it take the federal government to address the non-discretionary part of the budget? I'm going to give you a 15-second budget primer, and then so that I can frame up the answer for you. If you look at the federal budget today, we spend about $3.5 trillion a year. Of that, $2.4 trillion of that is mandatory spending. It goes on and on and on, unless Congress changes the underlying law. In other words, unless Congress changes Medicare, changes Medicaid, changes Social Security, Congress can't touch those. So in other words, if somebody's eligible for Medicare, they go say, I'm eligible for Medicare, and the check gets sent out the door. And so that's the biggest part of our budget. I've got a Pac-Man screen that I use to show how that part of the budget has grown over the last few decades and where it's headed. The discretionary part of the budget is about $1.1 trillion, and that's what Congress really gets to fool with every year when we go through the appropriations process. Now, the part that's breaking the bank of our kids' and grandkids' future is the part of the budget, the mandatory part of the budget that Steve asked in his question. And he said, is there a way to fix it short of a crisis? Probably not. I'd like to say that it would be. Now, I will tell you there are visions out there about how to do it. If you look at the last five budgets that the House has passed, we have gone up and put our finger on that third rail of Medicare, and we fixed Medicare for generations. We put our finger on the third rail of Medicaid and fixed it for generations. We have been not allowed by our leadership in the House to touch the other third rail of entitlements, that's Social Security, but that one's easy to fix, believe it or not. You twist three knobs and you can fix it for 75 years, which in congressional terms is infinity. And I'm serious. Now, the only caveat to that is when we fix the SGR, the sustainable growth rate, and you doctors know what I'm talking about, that saved your kids and grandkids $2.5 trillion of taxpayer money over their lifetimes. And so there might be some ways until you get a unified Congress and a unified White House to make some changes. But other than that, I think it's probably going to take some sort of a crisis. The first time the Treasury goes to the Treasury markets and tries to issue Treasury bonds or Treasury notes and you have a hiccup in the market, is going to be the day that everybody says, oh, that's the day of reckoning. But it will be bad when it happens, Steve, because today we pay about $200 billion a year in interest. If we went to a more normalized interest stream, we'd pay $800 billion a year. We only spend less than $600 billion for defense. So just think about what would happen if suddenly you had to take $600 billion of your budget and go to interest cost. So it is something that keeps – I don't want to make light of this because it's something that keeps me awake at night. This is the reason I'm up there. My two wheelhouses in Congress are budget because I'm a CPA and energy because I'm a former oil and gas guy. And, I'm trying to fix all of these things as well as, you know, a whole handful of other odds and ends as well. Next question. I think this will be my last question. Yeah, one last question. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So the public is recognizing the need for transportation funding and they're willing to pay additional taxes to fund that. Why can't we get something done in Congress to give a long-term transportation funding mechanism?
Well, I don't know if y'all heard the question or not. He said, what can be done in Congress to give us a long-term transportation funding solution? Let me start out by saying that the funding solution we have down, the federal gas tax at 18.3 cents a gallon, has not been changed since 1994, I think. And it is not funding our highways. Also, there are set-asides that are being – there are diversions of that trust fund, which is supposed to be for roads and bridges, that are being used for mass transit, for bike paths and beautification. Now, that is substantially skinnied down over the last 4 years since folks like me got elected. In a perfect world, what you would do is you would say, okay, states, really, you own this. You know, the federal – the interstate system is built out, and the states own it. And so I think the solution would be is to reduce the federal footprint, let the states do what they do best. We actually, in the last transportation bill, which was called Transportation 21, I think, something like that we passed 2 years ago, set up a couple of pilot projects in Texas and in California to say, here, we're going to give you more authority over how you do your permitting and your environmental reviews and so forth and how you come up with funding. And I'll tell you what, in Texas, it worked well. We laid down a lot of concrete and built a lot of bridges, and we got a lot of stuff underway. And so we're going to expand that. So you got to have two parts to this. You got to reform the way the money is being who has control of how the money's spent. And that's best done at state and local level. And then the second thing is, how do you come up with the money? And so what we're – a six-year transportation bill will cost about $90 billion, and we're hoping to use international tax reform as the funding mechanism for that. I don't like that linkage a lot, but without going into details, Paul Ryan has convinced me it's a good way to do it, and so I'm supportive of the effort. Stay tuned. I think – I'm hopeful that we get that done in the fourth quarter of this year – well, in the November – December – excuse me, in the October-November time frame this year. Because right now the transportation funding the gas tax highway fund goes into deficit again beginning October 29th. I think there's solutions. Just hang tough with us for a minute. Might be a bright spot. Who knows? Anyway, I know you're frustrated with the way things are going in Washington. I don't blame you. I am too. I think if we remember that this country is still an exceptional country and that we pray that it remains exceptional and pray that for it and for our uniformed men and women, not only those here locally that protect us, but those that protect us overseas, I think we'll get it back to being Reagan's vision of a shining city on the hill. Thank you, and God bless you.